This is Rooted Recovery Stories. I'm Patrick Custer, your host, and absolutely so excited to be here with you today. As you can tell on our set, this isn't our normal set. We're in LA here with my new good friend, Griffin Mark. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah. I am so excited to talk about your story because it's got so many elements that are such a significant example of the transformational power of healing that can happen through trauma.
Yeah.
When I ask you about your first memory and describing what life was like around that time, what was that first memory and what was your life like?
My first memory from childhood, just any memory?
Yeah, when you remember like the first,
Jeez. Well, I will say that I always laugh, and that's not really funny, but you know, my childhood is kind of a blur.
Yeah.
And I feel like I now know as an adult that usually that happens when you have a lot of trauma, your brain tries to protect you. And I guess in some way I got lucky, but I would say my first memories would be liking to have fun, right? I liked to do what most kids would like to do. I love to make little skits and do little performances and get on camera. And then I also feel like most of my memories would be, you know, my grandma raising me and not really knowing why my life was different. You know, why my day-to-day life seemed and felt so different than other people, you know?
How did that start? Because the point at which your grandma was raising you, I know, was much later.
Mm-hmm.
What was going on in your house and what led up to the point of your grandma raising you?
So I remember very little until I was about, I thought I was older, but about 5 or 6, I was living with my mother, and my dad lived separately with my grandmother. Right. So during that time, my mother struggled with addiction, right, and mental health. And I was basically had to decide at that young age if I was going to go with the court actually allowed me to make the choice, which at the time I just remember thinking, I'm going to go with my grandma. And from that age on, around 5 or 6, my grandma raised me. So then in that household is my grandmother, my parent and my grandpa, and then my dad. My dad lived in the house with me, and my mother was unfit to raise me. So unfortunately I had to leave, and I didn't know what was going on. You know, I knew something was off, you know, I just wanted to live in my little make-believe world, and just, it was my circumstances. It was all I knew.
Yeah.
You know, so it really didn't seem too different, but at the same time I knew, why are there police here? Why are people asking me where I want to go? And can I just, you know, love my mom and be with my mom, even though maybe she's different?
Yeah. It's worth mentioning that, you know, before we always try and take a moment to reverently just kind of talk through some things before these interviews. And before the show, we were doing what we typically do and kind of try to reverently ask questions and just touch base on some of the really sensitive topics that we're talking through. And I had asked you about how old you were when you had to make this huge life decision as a child. And you at the time told me you thought you were 13, and we did a little fact checking with your sister.
Yeah.
And it turns out you were how old?
I was five or six.
That's huge. You were a baby.
I was a baby, but I'll tell you one thing. I didn't like, As much things as I do not remember as a child, I remember that night vividly, right? And I just assumed I was much older than that. And I remember just, you know, the visual that I have right now is I was standing outside my mother's house in Washington State. There were police, you know, cars, lights, and then there was my mom, and then there was me, my grandma, my dad, and police, and they were like, hey, where do you want to go? And being a people pleaser then and still now, I was like, I don't want to leave my mom. Like, I want to be with my mom. But I went ultimately with my grandma. And then I lived with my grandmother. She raised me. My father lived with us. He raised me as well, you know, and my grandpa. my mom just wasn't fit to raise me because of, you know, mental health and addiction.
Yeah. What was your awareness, like going forward, the narrative, right? Like you were very young. So I'm curious about what was her level of involvement in your life? Was there any in the years following? Did you get to see her? What was your understanding as a child of why this was the case?
Yeah. So basically, before I was asked where I wanted to go, my mom would just get, she'd come around like once every few months, if I were lucky.
Sometimes. What were her drugs of choice? Do you mind me asking?
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah. So everything.
Okay.
So she, alcohol, heroin, meth, I mean, really just everything. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember one time she came over to visit me at my grandma's. And, you know, she just wanted to see me. Like, she, you know, she would just pop in sometimes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my family tried to protect me. And my grandma would try to, you know, have her not come see me to protect me. And I was like, I just want to see her. One time I peed my pants. Not because I had to pee. I'm sorry. Not because I was excited, but because I wanted to see her so badly that I held my pee for so long. Just because I was worried that she would leave and I would never see her again.
Oh my gosh.
She had this big van. She lived in the van. And she came, I ran outside and I stood there and I just peed myself while we talked. And she didn't know, but I was like, I knew if I went inside, she would drive away. And I had no idea if I'd ever see her again. So she would come sporadically. And then my grandma would try to protect me. And I was like, no, you know. And so one time she came over and she was just like 90 pounds, you know, like skeleton, sticking bones from meth. And I knew like what was going on, but I didn't really understand what was going on. But I was like, why does my mom look so different? Why is she so skinny? And, you know, And so that was how it was with my mom and I. I would see her like once every 6 months. Mm. And then I would go visit her. She'd get some kind of, you know, get some leeway and my family would trust her. And then something would happen. And then I'd have to call and be like, Grandma, can you come pick me up? They're doing weird things. I don't know what they're doing, but they were doing drugs.
Yeah.
You know, and then it was pretty chaotic, but that's all I knew. That's just all I knew.
Wow.
You know, and my grandma would just sugarcoat everything. Oh, it's fine. You know, they're just, everything's fine. You know, like, you know, grandma's, is my mom going to die or, you know, and no, because she wanted to protect me. Mm-hmm. So I had this like false belief of everything. And, you know, everything that I knew something was wrong or I knew something was off.
Yeah.
But like, you know, if I came home from the fair and there were cops at my house, I'd be with my friends and like their parent, again, grade school, like probably 8, 9. And I knew something was wrong, but then I would lie and be like, oh, like that's weird. Someone must have broken into our house. And then my grandma would lie to me and be like, but now as an adult, it's because, you know, there's things going on.
It's so interesting that you bring this up because we talk about the addiction being a family disease. Mm-hmm. And so much of the time there's shame and guilt around there, every single aspect of it. So, that's so often, even when I'm talking to people and doing these interviews, being able to recall what you just described is still tucked away.
Yeah.
Because it's so shameful. The fact that you have to lie to your friends and then your primary caregiver at this point is also lying to you. There's a domino effect of alternate truths going on. And that was a representation of what must have been the reality of your life for years.
With everything. I mean, you know, it wasn't just my mom. You know, she'd come and go. It was just with everything. And my grandma, thank God, you know, she was there. I have no idea where I'd be if she wasn't, but it was her role to protect me from everything. You know, like my father also struggled with addiction. It was a family disease on both ends for me. You know, and so when he would be gone, I'd be like, just rippled with anxiety of, is my dad going to die?
Right.
You know, and she would just be like, no. He's going to be fine. Oh, you know, he's just at the store. He went to run an errand, but I knew. I was like, no, he didn't. you know? And then like, as time went on and I got older, I knew what was going on, and that just became accepted. Oh, my dad's gone. You know, he'll be back in a few days. Or, so it was just everywhere.
Right. The internalized shame is shame. God, shame is one of the biggest under the fear umbrella. You know, we're talking about this the other day. It is one of the biggest motivators in a negative way. And we don't even realize we're operating under the umbrella so much of the time, especially as young people. And, so I'm curious what your awareness of at the time. Clearly you knew something was going wrong. When you, if you look back and you take yourself to the place where you knew what was going on with your mom, you knew what was going on with your dad, and the first time you can probably remember not justifying it away or telling yourself lies, like you were fully in real awareness of what that was, admitting it to yourself. Do you remember what your own internal dialogue was around what your future looked like and what you didn't want it to look like?
Oh, that is such a great question and a loaded one in a good way. You know, it's like, I guess the best way I can explain that is, my sister, who's, you know, alive and well, because I had, you know, another
How many sisters or siblings did you have?
Three.
Okay.
My oldest sister, Linda, passed away in 2012. And now it's just my sister and I who lives here in Los Angeles near me. Going back to the question, it's like, my sister was very driven growing up. She wanted to get the hell out of there and, you know, had goals in school. I didn't have anywhere to, I didn't really have any escape or outlet to escape, you know, the trouble that I was facing at home, because then in school I was gay at the time. I didn't really know what that was. Again, I was like, why am I different? Why does everything seem so different for me? You know, so then I dealt with, you know, I was bullied so severely that I had nowhere to go, and I just internalized everything. So I don't really think I even thought, I'm not going to be this or that. I didn't really care, because I was just trying to make it through like the day. Literally, I would just, you know, so I would go to school. Never, no one knew anything about, you know, my family, or, you know, like I said, if we came home with kids in school and there was police, I would just make up some crazy lie. I don't know what I would say. And then, so no one at school knew what was going on at home. And then I'd go to school and get bullied. And then I'd go home and no one at home knew what was going on at school. So I was just in my own little, you know, world. And I think that's why I, you know, kind of gravitated towards, acting, you know, like, I think that was the, you know, I'd do the school plays, I would do the assemblies, or I would get involved in something to express myself. And then I would get bullied too badly to where I wouldn't be able to do it.
Yeah. But while you were expressing yourself and acting, you get to step into the shoes of someone else's story, where you're not, for those moments, you're not living your own reality.
Yeah.
That had to have been some sense of a outlet for relief.
It was, but it was more like, I was going to say that sounds intense, but it doesn't. It's very, you know, normal, but it's like, I knew, I was like, okay, well, if I do this play and, like, you know, have fun and whatever this is I'm doing, I was like, if I do this, I know I'm going to enjoy it. I was like, but I also know that someone's probably going to scream fag at me, right? Or
during the play?
Yes, always. I think I manifested it more than anything, because I'd be so terrified that it would happen. And then, you know, so I would be like, well, so then I would just stop doing things.
Wow.
I mean, I ended up dropping out of school because of, I was, you know, bullied too much. I dropped out in the beginning of 11th grade.
Really?
Yeah.
Holy cow.
So it was like, well, I want to do that, but I'm not, because... Yeah, I mean, like, think back in the movie Carrie, right?
Yeah.
It's like, that was, I mean, granted, it wasn't blood, but it would be, you know, the typical stuff that people do, LGBTQ deal with, when their kids were walking through the hallways and getting yelled at. I would just pray during passing period that I wouldn't, you know, I would make it through. I actually would get tardies. Is that what they're called?
I don't know. So a little bit about me. I was homeschooled K through 12, and I'm such an extrovert that I always wished I had gotten to go to school. But the more and more I talk to people, I'm also gay. And the more and more I talk to people and hear about their school experiences, it might not have been so easy on me if I had actually gotten to go to school.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I have heard the word tardy. That's probably, I don't know if that's what they called it in your school.
Well, I would get tardies going. I wouldn't be late to school. My grandma would drop me off, but I would be late to class in between passing periods because I would wait in class until the bell rang to get through the hallways without having kids in the halls because they would torture me so much.
My God.
Mentally, well, sometimes physically. So I would literally get into the next class. Let's say, like, I don't know, it's all a blur, like fourth period or something. I'd get, you know, written up for being late. I'm like, really? I'm getting written up because I'm hiding from all the students. But I didn't want to bring any attention to the fact that I might be gay. Right. I didn't want anyone to know. So I would never.
So you wouldn't tell. It's not like you could go to the guidance counselor and tell them, or you felt the freedom to.
I told no one.
Yeah.
And I will say I had some really cool girlfriends who were like my little pack of wolves that would stick up for me.
Mm-hmm.
Cause I wanted to have fun. I wanted to be, you know, cool and do cool things. But I was like, well, if I go to this party tonight, I'm probably going to get, you know, beat up by the older guys. It was just, but I never wanted anyone to know. So I basically at home, I had, you know, my home life. So I had nowhere to go. So it's like, when I dropped out of school, I didn't give a shit. I was like, I'm just going to go work. And I always knew I was going to move to Los Angeles to act. Mm-hmm. You know, it was my dream. It was always my dream. But at the time I was like, I'm out of school now. I can be gay. I can go to Seattle and meet gay people. I worked at Sam's Club, like a Walmart in Washington State. I was pushing carts, collecting carts for the store. And I met a couple of gay guys in the parking lot. And I thought, oh my God, those are gay guys. Got a boyfriend and then started doing all the gay shit. Going to underage gay bars. And then just from that point on, the moment I dropped out of school, and I met a couple gay people and found Seattle, the gay area, Capitol Hill in Seattle. I was like, oh my God, I'm out of here. I'm gay now. I can be myself. That's kind of like how the whole transition happened.
So I'm interested in asking you, because this happens so often, and maybe this wasn't the case with you, but with the trauma that occurred in your life and in the different realms, you had to be a certain version of yourself at school, a certain version of yourself at home, and tell different truths about the in between. It makes sense to me that you developed such a strong skill of compartmentalization that aided you and assists you probably still to this day in acting, right? But when you think about the time where you were like, I can finally be myself, did you ever hit a point in adulthood, like from then forward, where it can be really hard to transition into a place of finding one authentic version of you?
Yeah.
Was that your experience? Or what was it like once all the pieces could come together for Griffin instead of being different worlds that never were allowed to mix?
Well, I will say that, you know, because I lived about 45 minutes south of Seattle in a small town called Sumner, Washington. And I would just drive to Seattle on the weekends and I'd do my gay stuff and then come back to Sumner and lie. I got used to lying because I grew up with it. And so I was like, well, I'm not doing anything wrong. I'm just lying like everyone else. And then I just kind of went from, I don't know. I was like wearing like crop tops and thongs and G-strings. And I was like, I want to be as gay as I possibly can. And I loved it. And so I'd come home and I guess that felt authentic to me because I was like, I just wanted to be gay and out. Mm-hmm. Right. But that was just in Seattle, not in my hometown. And then my grandma being the wonderful woman that she was, you know, she started finding my belongings and she'd be like, she would just fold them and put them back in my cabinets. She wouldn't say anything. Mm. Remember? Cause she would hide everything from everyone. So she would just put it away. And I was like, what a great, that just demonstrates how incredible my grandma was, that she didn't say anything. She just put them away for me. And I was like, well, she knows I'm gay now, obviously. So that felt authentic for me, where I was able to go express myself on the weekends in Seattle and just walk around and be an 18-year-old gay kid with gay people around me. And I started meeting a lot of people. And that's ultimately it was almost like a double-edged sword for me, because it's how I started expressing myself, mm-hmm. but then that's also when I got heavily into drinking.
Right. So you've got all this internalized pain and negative energy and things that don't have any trauma that never had anywhere to go because you didn't have proper coping mechanisms to deal with it. It's only normal that I think most people find either and or behaviors and or chemicals to use as unhealthy coping mechanisms. And so, you know, in the gay cis male, like you're describing the gay cis male society or scene, it is often, for those who don't know, I mean, it is a common thing for this story to be repeated, where we're not accepted, we can't be who we are. Once we finally get to that place, we have all this underlying trauma and baggage that it's got, like, rather than what I guess a normal young person might party, we're partying our asses off to not feel anything whatsoever. And so what did that lead? I mean, like, when you're looking at your life at that point, because Griffin before this, I'm going to go to LA, I'm going to be successful, I'm going to, you know, all these hopes, wishes, and dreams. And then you're in this, the throes of partying and whatnot, and destructive behavior. What kind of transpired from there, and consequences did you experience that changed your life?
Well, I remember when I was, you know, even like 15, 16, because I dropped out of high school when I was 17. And, you know, even like in school, I didn't care to drink much. Like, I didn't really, because I didn't want to, I guess. I felt so uncomfortable that I think once I started going out to the gay bars and underage and meeting gay people, I just was like, wow, this is what we do. We drink a lot. Mm-hmm. Like, we just drink, we get messed up, and we party our butts off. Like, that's mm-hmm. all I started associating that lifestyle with being gay, mm-hmm. right? So that's all I got weekend after weekend, weekend after weekend. It just was my new norm. So I think when it was time for me to move to Los Angeles at 20, because I told myself I'm moving to LA when I'm 20. I was like, I got to be out by the time I'm 20 years old. I was like, you know, 2 weeks after my 20th birthday, I moved here. And I was like, okay, I'm here. I'm going to act. I'm going to go, you know, get it and go to theater. I'm going to do all the things. And then because that lifestyle had become so normal for me, I remember one day I was like driving down Santa Monica Boulevard, and this older gentleman, someone in my life at the time, was like, hey, well, you know, you're new here. I just want to warn you, like, don't get sucked into West Hollywood, because it will suck you in and spit you out. And I thought, I'm not getting sucked into West Hollywood. You know, I'm here to act. I'm here to, you know, follow my dreams.
And for those who don't know, West Hollywood is the, what would you say, the gay mecca of LA, like, where?
Oh yeah, West Hollywood is the gay mecca of, and listen, I live in West Hollywood. I've lived here for 18 years, but it's like, West Hollywood is like the gay mecca of the world. West Hollywood, California, are you kidding me? Little did I know, maybe I knew deep down, but I was like, I moved, you know, I literally moved to West Hollywood. Mm-hmm. Not knowing that I had created all of these new coping mechanisms. Mm-hmm. And so I was driving down West Hollywood, you know, driving down Santa Monica Boulevard, and this guy was like, don't get sucked in. I was like, I won't. And jumping around from that age, I think 20 until like 30, 32, 33, I was sucked in. It's all I did. I did the same thing I was doing in Seattle here. So for like 10 years of my life in LA, I just was like, stopped acting, worked at, you know, random bars, go-go danced all over. I didn't give it. All I wanted to do was party and lose my mind. I had fun. I had a blast, right? But now I look back and I'm like, oh my God, what did I do for 12 years? That's all I did. That's all I cared about.
Right.
Because it's what I developed coming out of the closet. I developed that I'm gay. This is what we do. We drink, we do drugs, and we party. Mm. And so now, you know, that I'm a little older, I'm like, oh my God, wow. That's all that I knew. That's all that we know. You know, it goes way back to Stonewall.
Absolutely.
It's what we've been conditioned to believe that our narrative is.
Right.
So we don't see anything wrong with it until you end up, you know, in my mind, you know, addicted to drugs or alcohol.
Right. And there's some form of your personal bottom that you hit that is a cup full of consequences.
This podcast is brought to you by Promises Behavioral Health. If you or a loved one are struggling with trauma, addiction, or mental health, we are ready to answer your questions and help you take that next step. Call our admission center at 888-648-4098 or visit us online at www.promises.com. Our team is ready and waiting to answer the call for help.
I want to also ask you, and not everybody has this place of perspective, but I'm curious if there's a point where, because I asked you a few minutes ago when we were talking about awareness of what was going on with your father, your mother, when you fully admitted to yourself that they were in a, you know, addiction, an addiction lifestyle, and you were thinking about your future and what you wanted that to be. Was there a point where, because I remember, I'm in recovery myself, mm-hmm. and as much, even though the majority of the time I like lived in the city of denial, there were glimpses of time where I would have like moments of reality creep in and I would have a perspective shift. Was there any point where, you know, you're going through this, what, 10-year period, and you're thinking, am I just repeating my, am I doing what I said I was never going to do? Did you tell yourself, actually, the better question is, when you were younger, did you tell yourself, I will never be them?
Yeah, I think my main thing was like, I'm moving to California. When I hit 20, I'm out of here, you know? And I always kind of just knew that's what I was doing. And so I thought that was my ticket out. You know, I think I had like this, I had a lot of empathy for my parents, right? Specifically my mom. I almost felt bad for my mom, even at a young age, right? It was never like, oh, how dare, I never got mad at my mom. I was never mad at her. Anytime we had a chance to talk on the phone or I would see her, I would never be mad. I would just be happy to see her. And I felt, I broke my heart, right? So I think that allowed me to have more empathy compared to, you know, I'll never be like that, because honestly, you think that I would have just chose to never drink or do drugs mm-hmm. ever. My sister did. My sister, she's, you know, she doesn't work a program. I mean, she works her own, you know, spiritual program, but she just chose from a young age, I'm never getting involved in this. And she did it. I, on the other hand, was like, well, I'm gay. This is what we do. I, you know, we drink a lot. Like I'm normal. Like I'm okay. Like, I'm not, you know, addicted to anything. This is just what we do as gay people. Mm-hmm. So I never really thought like, I'm never going to be like that. I just thought I'm going to get the hell out of this small town where people have been, you know, harassing me for years. I'm going to just move to California and chase my dreams and be some, you know, famous actor. You know, at 20 years old, I was just like, I'm going to move to Hollywood. And so that was just all I dreamed of.
Yeah.
And so I think the empathy I had for my mom allowed me to have more empathy for addiction. But yeah, and then it's different with my dad and I. My dad and I have a different relationship. I'm more angry with him. And, you know, there's a difference there.
Can I ask you why?
Yeah, it's because my mom wasn't really around and I wasn't under the same household as her. Mm-hmm. And my dad was. We lived together. My grandma raised me and my dad was there the entire time. So I witnessed it firsthand, you know, and I built up a lot of resentment and anger towards him.
Is he the more stable one?
Yeah, my dad paid the bills, you know, when he wouldn't come around or when he wouldn't come home after, you know, while he was using, my grandma would be, you know, just riddled with anxiety. And I took that in, you know, and it, you know, developed me as an adult today is, oh my God, like, you know, things are not okay. And so, but we depended on him for finances. So when he would not come home and spend all the money on his drug of choice, you know, we were, would have no money. And I would watch my grandma just stay up all night. And then I would stay up all night. Is he going to die? And I'd go through the phone book, you know, back in the day, the yellow pages.
Mm-hmm.
I'd go through the yellow pages and try to find, I don't know what I was looking for. I was looking for roadside assistance, right? Because mm-hmm. I'm like, my dad's going to die. And my mm-hmm. grandma would be like, he's okay. She would just always reassure me. Because so every weekend it was like this consistent, you know, chaos.
Wow.
And if it wasn't for my grandma sugarcoating things to protect me, I have no idea. So that's all I knew. And what do they say? It's a family disease.
It's a family disease. But immediately when you're saying that, you know where my mind went to is when you left home, started to follow your dreams. I'm going to go live out my, you know, step into my, who I really am, be openly gay, go to LA. It only makes sense to me that, so you had grandma helping to numb and protect you from the reality that was trying to break in and be harmful. You'd never had another coping tool other than grandma at that point. You leave, it only makes sense that grandma's gone. At that point, it's so easy. And like you said, like the combination of our society condoning and celebrating. I mean, like, it's just the truth. It's still, we've got so far to go and you know, the LGBTQ plus community, but especially gay men.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, you know, also it's like my dad always would say this about my oldest sister, Linda, you know, who passed away mm-hmm. from ultimately addiction. It's a family disease, right? It was on every spectrum for me. That's why I'm like, you know, I have it on my dad's side, I have it on my mom's side, you know, I'm fucked when it comes to that. And the fact that I've been drinking and trying to manage my own addictions I've been, you know, head underwater the last 20 years. So that's me, you know, my journey that I'm working on. And then my dad would always say, my sister's name was Linda, who passed away. He was like, you know, Linda didn't stand a chance. Mm. Linda didn't have a chance. And I thought, well, what did I have? You know, like, cause you know, did I not have a chance either? You know, I made it out. So I definitely think I just wanted to get out of my town. Mm-hmm. I wanted to move to California because I thought if I got to California, I could get away from the family dynamic of what I was used to, but only to find out it follows you, right? Because it, you know, it doesn't stay in your hometown. It follows you wherever you go.
Because you're a big piece of your family.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can you tell me a little bit about Linda and your relationship with her?
Well, my oldest sister, Linda, was funny. We had the same sense of humor. I have a niece. I don't see her often enough, and I think about that. She was really funny. She was hilarious. And she was the badass in my small town. She was the drug dealer. Everyone knew her. I mean, she was a badass. She would come walking into the little, you know, restaurants in my hometown, and she'd be like a leather jacket and her bike, and people were afraid of her, but she was, I kind of looked up to her. Like, she was like my big badass sister. Again, barely saw her.
How much older than you was she?
Oh God. Well, she passed away when she was 40 in 2012. I would say she was maybe like, I'm bad with numbers, like 12 years older than me.
Okay.
Maybe.
A good bit. Yeah.
Like,
so she was off adulting for the majority of your adolescence.
Yeah.
Like,
oh yeah.
Okay.
And I would say like,
when I say adulting, I don't mean actually adulting, cause it sounds like that wasn't what it was, but I mean, she wasn't living, under the roof as an adolescent like you were.
Yeah. No. And she was kind of, you know, she would take over and she would, you know, even help my mom at times. My oldest sister, Linda, was the one that got my mom into rehab.
Really?
Yeah. They had this weird dynamic where they were like mother, sister, but they would help each other through their own battles with addiction. And one would get one clean, the other would get the other one clean. And so she was, you know, she was a tough, tough woman. And so was my mom. But yeah, I mean, I was young. I was living in Los Angeles. I was, like I said, in that little party scene. And I got a, you know, call from my mom that she was like, hey, Linda's in the hospital. I was like, well, you know, I'm not surprised. Like, she'll be fine. And she'd passed away. Ultimately, it was, you know, lifelong addiction to meth. From a young age, and going back to what my dad said, she never stood a chance, because Linda as well had addiction on both sides. Everyone in her family, her dad, her mom. But she also had a grandma that tried to get her away from that, like my grandma did.
Mm.
I know that it's hard when it's everywhere you go and everywhere you look, and when it's in your family, but I do believe, for anyone listening, I know we all have a chance. You can't just say, well, this is it. My dad's famous words. It is what it is. And I hate that.
Mm-hmm.
And I do believe at times it is what it is. But if we think that, we're just going
then
to...
Then it is.
It is.
Then you're...
Right? Yep. Like, I could just say, well, addiction runs on both sides of my family. It is what it is. I'm just going to continue drinking and living this life because this is what it is.
Yep.
But I'm like, no, I want something more. I've always said, if you can experience darkness, mm-hmm. right? If you can experience darkness, which we all have and we all do, I truly know and believe that you can experience the most significant light in life.
Yeah.
And that's how it is. That's mm-hmm. how it has to be. If you can experience the darkest times in your life, I know that you can experience the most amazing things if we allow ourselves to.
Yeah.
And we don't just say, it is what it is.
That's so true.
You know, it is what it is. This is it. No, like hell no, absolutely not. I did not go through everything I went through as a kid, even as an adult, to just say it is what it is. Absolutely not.
So you, Linda passed, but that wasn't the end. You had some years in between, and then your mom.
Yeah, it was my oldest sister, Linda, passed in 2012. My mom passed in 2014. My grandma, who raised me, passed in 2015. And then in 2016, I was diagnosed with HIV.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was, at the time, it didn't seem like much. But yeah.
At the time, what didn't seem like?
Yeah. And when you say at the time, which thing? Because you just named four major traumas.
Well, at the time, I guess it just all happened so quickly that I didn't really realize until looking back. I'm like, oh God, that was a very, you know, traumatic lineup of events.
Yes.
HIV was something I was terrified of. I'm sure like most gay men were, I was terrified of HIV. So when I got diagnosed, I was so sick when I got HIV that I didn't really care when I got the diagnosis because I was so fucking sick.
So it had gone far.
Yeah, quickly.
Without you, you didn't know that you had it. Basically, your body was suffering at this point once you finally got the diagnosis.
And I kept getting wrong diagnoses, kept going in. I was so physically ill that I could barely go, but I was like, something's not right. They kept diagnosing me with gastro issues, pancreatitis, because I was drinking. So they were like, you need to stop drinking. You have pancreatitis. And I'm like... First of all, I was like, I want to drink. Don't tell me that. That goes to show how addicted to alcohol I was. I was terrified of never drinking again at that point in my life.
Of course.
And I thought, okay. And then it didn't get better. And then thank God for the LGBT Center in Los Angeles. I went there and they diagnosed me within minutes and came into the room. I had my sister. We were holding hands and she was like, you're HIV positive. And I remember my sister was had more concern on her face than I did because I was like, hey, we're going to be okay. I looked at her and I told her that. I said, I'm so sick. What can we do? And then they want to take you in that room after they diagnose you to like, make sure you're going to like not hurt yourself. And I was like, no, I'm not going in that room. I'm not going to jump off the bridge. I swear. Just tell me what I can do so I can feel better. Cause I was, it was terrible. And then thank God, I had an ex-boyfriend at the time who I did not give HIV to, and he took care of me. And it was a slow journey, but it you know, I'm now, that was 2016, we're in 2024, so I'm about 8 years HIV positive. I'm HIV undetectable. I'm healthier than I've ever been in my
Heck
life.
Yeah.
I've never felt better, and I have no shame about it. I did for a while because it's what we're taught to have.
Right.
And now I don't even think about it. I take a pill every single day. I take Biktarvy every morning, and I live my life. I'm healthier now than I was when I was HIV negative. I know that because I was reckless, and it allowed me there. The silver lining to getting HIV allowed me to take my health into my own hands.
Right.
And now I know every little thing about my blood. I know every little thing about what everything means. I mean, I used to not even know what cholesterol was until I got HIV, because now I'm like, hey, how's my cholesterol? How are my triglycerides? How is this? Oh, I'm undetectable. My CD4. Yeah. So it was a long journey, but yeah, I'm an openly proud HIV undetectable male.
What would you say about, because that journey, if you were to give me a description of the process of immediately walking into the shame, dealing with the physicality of it, where did you go with the recovery, and when did you decide that you were gonna be open
about with my status?
Yeah.
Well, oh my God, I remember, like, you know, I still get that fear sometimes. If I don't feel comfortable, I'm not gonna like say, hey, I'm HIV positive. But it was in 2020 and I was drinking a lot during the pandemic. I had nothing to do for a while. And I was just drinking heavily. And one day I was like hungover, probably still drinking. And I said, I'm gonna post on Facebook and I'm gonna out myself, because it's, if I don't do it now, I'm never gonna have the courage. So I had liquid courage, and I posted on social media, and I came out with my status, and then I deleted it because I was like, oh my God, what did I do? And now I'm just much more confident and comfortable in myself today. I'm like, hey, yeah, you know, and if I can help one other person know that it's going to be okay, then that's all that matters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, with all of the things that we talked about that have really shaped so much of your life, the negative and the good, but specifically the negative, I'm curious about, what would you, when looking back, what has made the biggest difference bringing you to a place of healing? Because you are clearly a well-adjusted, healthy man sitting before me with a passion for other people, for life, and that you don't just do that overnight.
Yeah. It's been a long journey. I remember being, you know, 20 years old, 21 years old, calling home to my grandma, and, you know, being like, I don't know if I want to drink anymore. I mean, I'm 38. So that was what, 18 years ago. I've always known that alcohol was an issue for me. And I've gone through my journey, and I don't really take it serious enough. And by serious enough, I mean, in 2022 or 2021, I walked into an AA, you know, meeting. I said, well, fuck, something's got to change.
Yeah.
My journey didn't start seriously with sobriety until 2021. You know, I did AA, I tried AA, I loved it. I met incredible people. It got me to where I am today. I currently no longer work an AA program. I just do my own stuff based on sobriety and what works for me. I don't necessarily like the word sober for myself. I just stopped drinking, right? So I'm coming up on 3 months alcohol free. In 2022, I had, you know, 8 months of the year I was sober at the time. But now it's like, now I've learned that progress is not linear, and it's going to look like this. It's going to look like this. You're going to have high highs. You're going to have low lows. Yeah. You're going to start over what can feel like horrible. But now I've just realized, hey, today I don't drink. Tomorrow I have absolutely no idea. I don't know if I'll be drinking tomorrow.
Well, and whether you're an AA or any other form of 12 step or any other form of recovery.
Yeah.
That's a tenet that we are supposed to embrace, because, like, yeah, if you at any point think, I've got it, I'm fixed.
Yeah, exactly. And so I don't even want to say, oh my God, I'm never going to drink again, because I just have to listen one day at a time.
Yeah.
In life, with everything, with everything. And I also know, to answer your question as well, that I couldn't really heal while I was constantly drinking, right? So when I get uncomfortable now, I'm like, ooh, this is why I would drink. This is why I would grab that bottle of wine. I never allowed myself to get uncomfortable. And now without alcohol, I have two options. I can sit in it, which I do, but then I can find other things to do to cope with it. Yeah. So now I can use that creativity that I had when I was a kid before all the pain happened and I was starting to understand what was going on in my life, right? That little kid in me that was like, I want to act. I want to be an actor. I want to move to Hollywood. Now when I have all this sober time, I'm like, I'm going to get into class. I'm going to do this audition. I'm going to find ways to get in touch with that kid again and use my creativity, because alcohol was killing my creativity. And it kept me, I've always said this, and I thought I was special, but I've realized now it's very common, especially in the sobriety world, in chains. Alcohol kept me chained to the ground and I felt as if I could never break free.
Yep.
And now without alcohol, I'm like, I can do things. Mm-hmm. And I'm excited to see what can happen now that I'm letting go. I'm sorry, letting go? Yes, I'm letting go of alcohol. I'm not giving up, right? I'm letting go of alcohol. I'm quitting alcohol. I'm not giving up alcohol is what I'm trying to say. Because when you say you're giving up, you think you're giving up something. And as long as you continue to think you're giving up something, you're going to always feel like you're missing out.
Right.
And I'll tell you one thing from experience, that will not keep you sober.
Right.
You have to change your mindset. So I quit. It wasn't working.
Yeah.
So.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the deal right there. Thank you so much. Bringing this level of vulnerability is not easy. We open up this huge box of trauma and, in the hope that, and you know, always knowing that somebody is going to, many people are going to get something and encouragement from the story. Yeah. And in that regard, I always like to ask at the end of this, you know, for that person who, or people who have related to any part of your story, what kind of final encouragement would you like to leave with them?
Well, I'll leave something that my mom wrote me in a card, which I cannot find. And I'm going to rip through my apartment one of these days to find it. But in the card she wrote me, that I actually recited at her memorial, was she said, no matter what happens, no matter what you go through in life, no matter how many times you get knocked down, no matter how many times you fall flat on your face, grab onto something, grab onto whatever you can find, pull yourself up and just get up no matter how hard, because life can be really challenging at times. But I know that if you just continue on and try your hardest, that things can change. And it's not, it is what it is. It's what you make out of it. And I promise that if you have a bad day, no matter how dark, tomorrow's a new day. And I promise that if you can experience severe darkness in your life, you can experience incredible things.
Amen to that. The emotion that you're expressing right now is so powerful. Griffin, thank you. Thank you. And those words are so sacred and so true.
Thank you.
In memory of your mama, we offer that up.
Thank you.
Thank you. This has been a really, really special interview.
Thank you.
And thank you from the bottom of my heart. You are a true gift to this world, my friend.
Thank you.
I'm glad you're here.
Thank you.
And to those of you sticking with us to this amazing point of the story, the closing, I just want to remind each and every one of you that it is, in echoing what you said, it is never, ever, ever too late, no matter where you are, what you feel, to start loving yourself. And you are only ever one decision away from a completely different life.
This podcast is brought to you by Promises Behavioral Health. If you or a loved one are struggling with trauma, addiction, or mental health, we are ready to answer your questions and help you take that next step. Call our admissions center at 888-648-4673. 4098 or visit us online at www.promises.com. Our team is ready and waiting to answer the call for help.